terrorism as Russians are still mourning for 137 victims of the attack. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashim. I appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to the UN Security Council, where the UNSC has passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution contained in document S/2024/254 please raise their hand? Those against? Abstention. The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2728-2024.
The draft resolution was jointly submitted by the current 10 non-permanent members of the Council. 14 countries, including 4 permanent members of the UN body, voted in favor of the resolution, except the United States, which abstained from the voting. The actual draft demanded an immediate ceasefire in the holy month of Ramadan, leading to a permanent sustainable ceasefire in Gaza. But the Russian representative in a statement before the vote said that the word permanent had been omitted before the meeting. Over the past 5 months since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza, Washington has vetoed 3 draft resolutions on the Gaza ceasefire, sparking condemnations at home and abroad. Well, I'd like to talk, to bring in a couple of guests for this part of the news and looking at this UN resolution and what it means. First of all, George Zamouli, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute out of London, Metropolitan University out of Budapest and Saab Shaath, author and West Asia expert out of Belfast. Thank you both for being with me. Starting off with George, your perspective. Let's start from there. Your thoughts about the passing of this resolution.
Well, obviously, it's a source of considerable embarrassment for Israel. On the other hand, Israel has had to endure embarrassments such as this, and it will do so again. It did this, of course, back in 2016 during the last days of the Obama administration, where again there was a Security Council resolution condemning Israel's settlements program. United States abstained, but you know, relations between the Israel and the U.S. were soon restored. This is obviously painful for Israel. On the other hand, I think Israel knows that there's an election coming up in the United States. The Biden administration is obviously in terrible straits with its own supporters. We saw that in the primary in Michigan, where there was such an enormous uncommitted vote. So I think one has to look at it in terms of domestic American politics. I doubt whether this will have a long-term effect in U.S.-Israeli relations, however.
All right. Well, Saib, your thoughts on what does it mean, the passing of this resolution, in your perspective?
To me, it's very significant because after 6 months, the vote came nearly almost unanimous. Certainly significant because as well, Security Council resolution and the draft, when we look at them, when they are adopted, becomes as international law. And all parties need to abide by what in these resolutions or draft resolutions after the adoption. But the key is now what happens after the month Ramadan is over. It's 2 weeks, the call for the ceasefire in here. Because that's where can be the whole thing open for interpretation. So the United States of America and the West, as my colleague says just now, they wanted to use this for their electioneering or what. But it's an opportunity for the United States of America and the West at least to slow down the genocide and to stop it. if they want that. But the question will be asked, how long this will be, the ceasefire will be engaged after Ramadan. When we know there is 2 weeks only in left in Ramadan, would the United States of America try to enforce it? Would they use the mandate which is the Security Council can impose on countries, like what they did in Iraq or that? I doubt that, but at least it will open the international arena widely, especially in Europe. The European governments will face a lot of pressure from the public opinion, like in Canada, when it started with at least stop sending arms to Israel. Even it's minute, Canada doesn't send that much, but it's imperative that is fast and activated. And the same thing, sanction will start becoming more powerful and usable tool against the Zionist entity. And now this pariah state is really becomes in the eyes of the world by international law is a pariah state, and the move to sanction it from the societies up to the government level now is the route is open for that.
Well, George, do you think the UN will use the tools that it has to make sure that this is enforced? What if the Israeli regime just continues what it is doing, continuing with the genocide despite this resolution?
Well, exactly, because I don't see how the United Nations Security Council can enforce this resolution. The way the United States has done that in the past is if it uses military force against whatever power they want to use force against. It's not going to use force against Israel. It's not going to impose any kind of sanctions against Israel. It's not going to cut Israel off from arms or any kind of assistance. It's not going to cut off diplomatic relations. So all it is a matter of some embarrassment. And even among the European states, I doubt whether any of them would seek to unilaterally impose some kind of measure of sanctions against Israel. I suspect Israel would just simply ignore this resolution, carry on whatever it's doing, because it doesn't really have any downsides, because they're dealing with Biden administration. They're not terribly happy with Biden, even though Biden has given them everything they want. But if Biden falls, because essentially he will lose support both among his Muslim voters, and he loses support because he's not sufficiently pro-Israel, and therefore he'll lose donors from the very powerful Zionist lobby, then in comes a Trump administration, or even if it's not Trump, it'll be a Republican administration that is bound to be even friendlier to Israel than the Biden administration has been. So for Israel, there's no downsides.
Okay, well, Seth, your thoughts in general on, at the end of the day, what it really means. So, okay, so this resolution was passed now. We're not expecting the Israeli regime tonight to all of a sudden just change its ways. It takes a few days or whatever. I mean, there's only 2 weeks left to the end of the month of Ramadan, and this is supposed to take effect immediately until the end of the month of Ramadan. I'm just wondering, at the end of the day, what does this really mean? What is it going to mean on the ground for the Palestinians?
What that means, it's helping, actually, the surrounding countries as well, because there is a famine happening right now, and the United Nations said in the past 48 hours, food, vital food aid to the North Gaza is halted. This is an order by the Zionists, and they tried to say they coordinated that with the United Nations, and the United Nations disputed that. So the Israelis halting aid coming to the north of Gaza. And we can see they are targeting all the aid going to the north of Gaza, killing the people who's gathering around there, raping women and destroying the hospitals in Gaza, like what we happened in Shifa Hospital, executing even children in that area. So there is the madness and the satanic activities of the Zionist entity become in a magnitude nobody can ever even imagine right now. So there is this resolution means to to muscle the aid in into Gaza and to halt or slow down the genocide, at least to make sure there won't, if there is a genocide, if there is famine hit Gaza right now, there will be regional conflict in the area. It doesn't matter, the Jordanian ones or the Egyptian ones, the people will break loose. Then this is what the Americans don't want to see, and they don't want to see they are the one who's arming that genocide. They're the one who at least can open the borders, land borders, with the Zionist entity to Gaza and let the aid flow. Guterres and the crossing in Rafah and seen miles upon miles and making alarming statements from there. The UNICEF, all the organization of the United Nations showing, and the World Health Organization as well. There is famine in a big scale is breaking out in Gaza, and that doesn't mean malnutrition. You can give the kids some food right now to recover. No, this is, they destroy them for a long, long, long time to come. So a lot of people in Gaza, even after they start receiving aid, they already lost their normal life. They lost their bodies. They cannot function as normal human beings.
Right.
And this is a journalist going to come right now and see all of that.
Yeah, and of course the psychological trauma on the kids and others. Thank you so much for being with us. George Amulu, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University out of Belfast, and Saab Shath, author and West Asia expert out of Belfast. We'll continue with our news bulletin now. Palestinians are facing an endless cycle of death and destruction as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza Strip enters its 171st day. And the latest Israeli strikes have claimed dozens of lives on the coastal territory. 22 members of the same family were killed when their home in Gaza's central city of Deir al-Balah was targeted. At least 10 people were killed in the Israeli bombing of the southern city of Rafah. Several Palestinians lost their lives in Israeli airstrikes on the Al-Shati refugee camp in northern Gaza. Regime's forces also besieged two hospitals in southern Gaza, apart from Al-Shifa in Gaza City. Meanwhile, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says Israel had informed the international body that it would no longer allow UNRWA food convoys into northern Gaza. Israeli genocide in Gaza has claimed more than 32,300 lives, mostly women and children, since October the 7th. Meanwhile, Palestinian fighters are putting up a stiff resistance to Israeli forces on the ground in Gaza, and at the same time, they continue their retaliatory attacks on the regime's targets. Military wing of the Hamas resistance movement says it has fired a barrage of rockets into the occupied city of Ashdod. The attack caused warning sirens to go off and prompted Israeli settlers to flee the city. The Al-Qassam Brigade says the attack was in response to the massacre of Gazans. Resistance fighters continue to target Israeli positions despite the regime's pledge to stop rocket fire from Gaza once and for all. Palestinians have also been battling with invading Israeli troops at different locations across the besieged territory. The Israeli military has already confirmed the death of over 250 of its troops since the regime's ground invasion of Gaza. Palestinians and several media outlets say the regime is hiding the actual number of fatalities among its forces to avoid the Israeli public anger. Well, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has strongly condemned Israel's decision to seize 800 hectares more of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank's Jordan Valley region. Nasser Kanani, in a statement, said the Israeli announcement to confiscate the land is an outright theft and a violation of international law that harms global peace. The spokesman called it part of Israel's evil policy of eradicating the Palestinian nation. Kanani urged the international community to take serious and deterrent action against the regime. He also reiterated Iran's call for the creation of a Palestinian state as the only solution to the endless Israeli aggression. Israeli media say the regime has already seized 800 hectares in the Jordan Valley to build more settlements. European Union and its key members, Germany and France, have condemned the Israeli seizure of Palestinian land. while Russians are paying tribute to the victims of Friday's terror attack at a concert hall near Moscow that left scores of people dead and scores of others injured. People are laying flowers and lighting candles in memory of the 137 people who lost their lives. Authorities say the death toll may rise as many of the wounded remain in critical condition. Four main suspects, all Tajik nationals, have been arrested. According to a court statement, two of the detainees have already pled guilty. They all have been remanded in pretrial custody until May the 22nd. On Saturday, President Vladimir Putin said the assailants were nabbed while attempting to escape to Ukraine. However, Kiev rejected the notion that it was involved in the incident. The attack has been the deadliest since the 2004 Beslan school siege that ended in 334 fatalities. Human rights activist Ryan Dawson talked to us about any potential nexus between Daesh and those involved in the attack on the concert hall in Russia.
You know, at least they caught them and they're being interrogated. They seem to be blaming this on Ukraine. Of course, Ukraine denies it. The men were trying to escape there. ISIS claimed responsibility for it, but it doesn't really fit the ISIS MO. They didn't martyr themselves. They all were captured, and they have also confessed to trying to collect payments later, which is not really how the Islamic State tends to operate. Well, there were terrorist attacks with drones last year, and Moscow was the target. Ukraine has done attempted terrorist attacks in the past. None of them were as successful as this one. This does seem to be a group of privateers. These are double-digit IQ mercenaries who were sent in to murder as many people as possible. It doesn't really benefit Russia to lie about Ukraine or ISIS. They're at war with both of them anyway. They've been at war with ISIS in Syria, and they've been at war with Ukraine for the past 2 years. So the evidence that they must have must indicate that these are Ukrainian-backed terrorist proxy forces, not proper military. And that's usually how terrorist acts are conducted by Western states, is through plausible deniability.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Trinity College in the UK has invested millions of dollars in companies involved in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza and businesses that benefit from the occupation of Palestine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, scores of students held a protest outside the University of Cambridge's wealthiest college recently to demand the higher seat of learning divest millions of dollars from companies arming, supporting, and profiting from the Zionist regime's war on Gaza. Demonstrators carried signs reading, cease fire now, and divest from genocide outside Trinity College following a story published by Middle East Eye last month, which found that the college had invested £61,735 in the Zionist regime's largest arms company, Elbit Systems. Based in the city of Haifa, Elbit produces at least 85% of the drones and land-based equipment used by the Zionist regime's army. The company's weapons have reportedly been used in Gaza since October 7th and are also reported to have been used in the occupied West Bank and southern Lebanon. Middle East Eye also revealed that Trinity has investments worth approximately $3.2 million in Caterpillar, a U.S.-based heavy equipment company that has long been the target of boycott campaigns for its sale of bulldozers to the Zionist regime's army. At least one of the banners held up at the recent protest explicitly referenced Elbit and Caterpillar's roles in the occupation of Palestine. As the world-leading educational institution, Trinity must not be investing in companies causing so much death and destruction that may amount to genocide, and instead should be supporting the college's mission of advancing education and research, the protesters said in an open letter. Pressure has been mounting on the Trinity College to divest from companies complicit in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza after the UK-based International Centre of Justice for Palestinians, ICJP, issued a legal notice to the institution warning that officers, directors, and shareholders at the college may be individually criminally liable if they maintain their investments in arms companies that are potentially complicit in Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity. On March 9th, an activist from Palestine Action spray-painted, then slashed a 1914 painting of Lord Balfour at Trinity. The incident, which was condemned by Britain's Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowen, is now under police investigation. To date, more than 31,000 Palestinians have been killed and at least 71,000 wounded in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza. The UN announced earlier this month that 80% of Gaza is now uninhabitable, while the hunger rate stands at 100%. The UN and several aid agencies have repeatedly warned that Gaza is on the brink of famine and have pressed the Zionist regime to allow aid in. At least 25 people have died from malnutrition and dehydration since the start of the war, including a 10-year-old child with the cerebral palsy last month. The UK joined Jordan, Egypt, the UAE, the US, Germany and France in coordinating aid drops with the Zionist regime in different areas of the blockaded Gaza Strip. However, the besieged Palestinians have said that airdropped aid quantities are too small to deal with the needs of a starving population in the Gaza Strip. We'll be right back. Meanwhile, Crescent International wrote, as the low-intensity regional war and transformation take shape in West Asia, the fronts against apartheid Israel and its Western enablers are acquiring a multidimensional character. One of those multidimensional characteristics involves a grassroots economic boycott by consumers of Western and Israeli businesses. Economic boycott against the Zionist regime is not a new phenomenon. It hits the apartheid entity where it feels and hurts the most. It's one of the most significant weak spots of the Zionist regime occupying Palestine. While purely econometric reasons are certainly important, it is only one of the factors and not the factor. A significant number of Zionist colonizers in Palestine hold foreign citizenship. Figures vary from 10% according to the Dual Citizenship Report to 17% according to Times of Israel Report of 2016 to 22% according to Israeli blogger Daniel Barobim. There is a speculation that the actual figures may be as high as 35% or even 50% of Israelis holding dual citizenship. They will not stick around in a hostile environment, which will become even more difficult as economic, political, and military pressure continues to increase on the Zionist regime. When a better option is easily available, away from war and economic ruin, not all, but many people will opt for the easier option, leave. Both the current Zionist mass murder campaign in Palestine and the regional assistance to Israel are unprecedented in nature and totally out of proportions. This applies to the economic and boycott angle of resistance against Israel and its Western enablers. What makes this current limited impact a longer-term strategic challenge to the Zionist regime and brands facing the grassroots boycott is that this time, due to the scale of events in the region, more people have joined and it is clearly having some impact. The phenomenon of limited impact creates a vicious perception cycle, which then translates into concrete negative monetary impact. As some brands can no longer conceal that the grassroots boycott is having an impact, more ordinary consumers are motivated by the fact that their objection to genocide in Palestine is working. This results in more people joining the boycott since they feel empowered. This phenomenon snowballs into a much bigger boycott movement. Those familiar with the politics of the so-called Muslim Street in West Asia and the Arab world know well that boycotting of brands closely associated with Western imperialist regimes has been around for decades.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Tonight I would like to actually go back to one phrase, one sentence from the dua that we discussed last night, where we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. After praising him, we say, فَصِرْتُ عَدُوكَ آمِنًا. You know, I continue to pray to you with hope. You know, not out of fear. I'm not scared. I have this confidence in how you have treated me in the past. And then we come to this sentence, فَإِنْ أَبْتَى عَنِّي أَطَبْتُ بِجَهْلِي عَلَيْكَ. If the response to my dua is being delayed from your side, you know, I, out of my ignorance, blame you. And I say, you know, Allah, what's the problem? And I'm praying to you every day, but there's no answer. And this is the dua coming from Imam Asr Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Faraju Sharif, where he's looking at a human condition. He's saying, yes, you feel bad about delaying of the dua. And sometimes you blame Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but confess that. لَعَلَّ الَّذِي عَبْتَ عَنِّي هُوَ خَيْرٌ لِي. That maybe something which has been delayed is for my betterment. Why? لِعِلْمِكَ بِعَاقِبَةِ الْأُمُورِ. Because you know the outcome of all affairs. I would like to focus on this part tonight, because this is a very common question we hear many times. That Maulana, I done all the amal. Whatever I hear from YouTube, from Maulana's on the member, and many other people, and I done this, I done that, and still I don't see any response. And they become kind of, disheartened, and sometimes even angry with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is where I would like to actually go to the forefather of our Imam, Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wa salam. There is a letter in there, in the section of the letters, letter number 31, where Imam is actually addressing one of his sons. Now, there's a debate about it, which son he was addressing. It's a lengthy letter that he wrote after the Battle of Siffin. And he has covered many, many things. It's actually a document about the tarbiyat of awlad, how to raise your children. In there, he talks about this issue. You know, especially if you remember the wordings of Dua Iftitah in the earlier part that we discussed, that we say to Allah that, you know, you are the one who has allowed me to pray to you. You know, and I, because of that, have this hope to ask you for things. And this is where Imam is writing to his son, وَعَلَمْ أَنَّ الَّذِي بِيَدِهِ خَضَائِنُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْعَرْضِ. Ali says that, know that the one who holds the treasures of the heavens and the earth, قَدْ عَذِنَ لَكَ فِي الدُّعَى. He has allowed you to basically pray to him and call him. He is somebody who holds the treasure of the universe. وَتَكَلَّفَ لَكَ بِالْإِجَابَةِ. And he has guaranteed you the response, the jawab. And this is the hard part to digest. You know, Allah, I'm calling you for 1 month and there's no response. And here Amir al-Mu'minin says, وَتَكَلَّفَ لَكَ بِالْإِجَابَةِ. He has guaranteed you the response. وَأَمَرَكَ أَن تَسْأَلُهُ لِيُعْتِيكَ وَاسْتَرْحِمُهُ لِيَرْحَمَكَ. And he has actually commanded you to ask him so that he may grant it to you. And he has asked you to, seek his mercy so that he may be merciful towards you. And so Amir al-Mu'minin here is basically the same theme that we see from Amir al-Mu'minin and the 12th Imam. And this is where we come to realize, sometimes people go into this discussion about Sanad. When you see the similarity in the style and the approach, you know that is the Imam and this is the Imam. And then Ali goes on to say, he says, remember that he has been so kind to you. You do one mistake, it's counted only as one. You do one good thing, it is counted as 10 times, the reward. And then he says, ثُمَّ جَعَلَ فِي يَدَيْكَ مَفَاتِيحَ خَضَائِنِهِ. And then Allah has placed in you, your hands, the keys to his treasures. The treasures of the heavens and the earth, he says, Allah has given you the keys. بِمَا عَظِنَ لَكَ فِيهِ مِنْ مَسْأَلَتِهِ. By allowing you to ask him. فَمَتَى شِئْتَ اِسْتَفَحْتَ. Whenever you wish, You can open the door بالدُعَاء أبواب نعمته. You can open the doors of his blessings through du'a. So the du'a is the keys to the treasures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is where, then Ali comes to this issue. That we see even the du'a of iftitah of the imam of our time. Where he says, وَلَا يُقَنِّطَنَّكَ إِبْطَاعِ إِجَابَتِهِ فَعِنَّ الْعَطِيَّ عَلَىٰ قَدْرِ النِّيَّةِ. This is where he brings up this issue of delay. He says, delay in acceptance of the dua should not disappoint you. Because always keep in mind, granting of the prayer is according to the worth of your intention. You know, what is the level that you are? At what level you are asking? What is your intention? Is there sincerity in that or not? That's a very important point that Ali is making here. And then he says, remember, there are three outcomes. When he says that Allah has guaranteed the response, there are three outcomes. The response might not always be what we want. But he says, number one, وَرُبَّمَا أُخِّرَتْ عَنْكَ الْإِجَابَةِ ليكون ذلك أعظم لأجر السائل وأجزل لإعطاء العمل. He says sometimes the delay, the acceptance of dua is delayed. It's not rejected. But you don't get it when you want it. You know, it is given to you later on. And so Amir al-Mu'minin says sometimes acceptance of dua is delayed for you, with the view it's being a source of greater reward to the supplicant and a better gift to the hopeful ones. Because this is where Amir al-Mu'mineen says that, you know, sometimes Allah delays. He's going to give you, but he controls the time, not you. He realizes this is not the time I'll give him soon. And this is where, you know, maybe I'll put in something else, which are there in hadith also, that sometimes when you do the dua with sincerity and cry to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, maybe Allah likes your voice. If he just gives you the first day, you will not go back to him. So he says, you know, I like the way you ask me. So do it again. And when you do that, the reward is multiplied. Maybe even what you are asking will be, what is given to you is more than that. And so the reward is more and the gift is even better than what you were expecting. So that's the first thing about the issue of delay.
Dear listeners of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, you can follow this program entitled Minbar every day in the month of Ramadan. If you have any suggestion, you can send us your email at englishradio@irib.ir.
Love is everywhere, so much peace fills up the air. Ramadan, month of the Quran, I feel it inside me, strengthening my iman. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, 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 ya Habib, Ramadan. ليتك دوما قريب, ليتك دوما قريب.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Many U.S. voters will be voting with one issue top of their mind, the state of the U.S. economy. Voters in a new poll have more favorable views of the economy under former President Donald Trump than of the economy under President Joe Biden. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A recent CBS News poll found that 65% of Americans remember the economy under former President Donald Trump as being good, compared with 38% giving the current economy under President Joe Biden the same positive assessment. In fact, almost 6 in 10 voters polled by CBS News described the U.S. economy under Joe Biden as bad, even as economists' views are much more upbeat due to the nation's stronger-than-expected gross domestic product, GDP, and low unemployment. Instead of entering a recession, as many economists had predicted last year, the economy appears to be on track to generate continued growth and more jobs once inflation recedes. The key to the disconnect could reside in how voters experience the economy between 2017 and 2019, during the first 3 years of Donald Trump's presidency prior to the pandemic's upheaval in 2020, compared with the post-pandemic years. These are two very different periods from an economic standpoint, noted Gregory Darko, chief economist at EY. The 2017 to 2019 period was the end of the strongest business cycle on record. The economy was doing well, the labor market was quite strong. We had the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years, we had an economy growing at a sub 2% rate, but still moving forward. Overall, he added, there was essentially a pretty steady state of the economy before the pandemic. In other words, the economy prior to the pandemic was chugging along, providing a strong, if not stellar, environment. But the post-pandemic economy introduced a number of upheavals, including a labor shortage and the highest inflation in the past 40 years, which has since receded but remains above its pre-pandemic levels. There is that sentiment that you are still coming out of a shock, he added. To be sure, presidents often get credit when the economy is performing well and are blamed when it tanks, even though there's a limit to how much influence the commander-in-chief has over such a complex system. Indeed, the economy's performance is often tied to boom and bust cycles that don't have much to do with who's occupying the White House. Here's what the data shows about the 2017 to 2019 economy under Donald Trump versus the 2021 to 2023 economy under Joe Biden. The major difference between the two periods boils down to inflation, or the upward change in prices for goods and services. From 2017 to 2019, inflation hovered at above 2% per year, a low enough level where people generally don't notice changes from day to day. But when the COVID-19 pandemic shut global supply chains and caused a labor shortage, prices shot up, with inflation hitting a 40-year high of 9.1% in June of 2022. Suddenly, shoppers were reminded of inflation each time they wanted to go to a grocery store, an issue that remains a pain point for consumers. Even though inflation has receded, prices aren't going back to their pre-pandemic levels, and that continues to eat into consumers' budgets. We're coming out of an environment where inflation has become a key topic, a key issue, a key point of conversation, whereas it wasn't for most of the three decades that preceded the pandemic, Darko noted. It's gone from a non-issue to an essential issue, and that for me is the key reason people are feeling more downbeat than economic conditions would dictate. Consumers value predictability when it comes to prices, something that Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell highlighted when he spoke with CBS News last month. "I can't overstate how important it is to restore price stability, by which I mean inflation is low and predictable, and people don't have to think about it in their daily lives," Jerome Powell said. Wages rose at about 3% annually prior to the pandemic, representing solid gains, yet far from the strides of the late 1990s when workers enjoyed pay bumps of about 5% annually. But more importantly, wage growth from 2017 to 2019 inched ahead of inflation, providing American workers with more purchasing power. That flipped in the wake of the pandemic, when wage growth failed to keep up with inflation. Suddenly, workers were losing purchasing power, an issue they encountered on every grocery trip when they faced sky-high egg prices and more costly basics. With wages trailing inflation, many felt they were losing ground. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Voters in a new opinion poll have more favorable views of the economy under former President Donald Trump than of the economy under current President Joe Biden. The poll, released on Sunday, 3rd of March, by CBS News YouGov, found nearly two-thirds of registered voters said the economy under Donald Trump was good, compared to about 38% who said the same for Joe Biden's economy. More than half, or 59%, said they would describe the current economy as bad, whilst about 28% said the economy under Donald Trump was bad. More voters said they believe Joe Biden's policies over Donald Trump's will increase prices, 55% to 34%. About 44% said they believe Donald Trump's policies will drive prices down, while 17% said the same thing for Joe Biden. About 27% and 22% said they believe Biden or Trump's policies respectively will have no effect on prices. The Biden administration has faced criticism when it comes to economic policies in the wake of stubborn inflation and increasing interest rates. The White House last year ramped up its messaging around so-called Bidenomics, and Biden has repeatedly touted increasing wages, rising job satisfaction, and restoring union pensions. Inflation, however, has largely cooled in recent months, and the Federal Reserve's policymakers earlier this year indicated they expect to cut interest rates 3 times this year. Joe Biden and Donald Trump's campaigns have taken aim at each other's economic policies on numerous occasions in recent months. In January, the Trump campaign released an advertisement titled "History Lesson," pointing out differences in gas prices, mortgage rates, and retirement savings under Donald Trump compared to Joe Biden's presidency. The latest opinion poll findings come out less than 2 days before Super Tuesday. Biden and Trump hold wide leads in their respective races. A hypothetical matchup between the two rivals shows that Donald Trump, with a nearly 3 percentage point lead over the incumbent Joe Biden, according to polling indexes by Decision Desk HQ and The Hill. The CBS News YouGov survey was conducted among a representative sample of 2,159 U.S. adults interviewed between 28th of February and 1st of March. The survey has a margin of error of plus or minus 2.8 percentage points. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials on the occasion of the month of Ramadan. We read in another part of the Holy Dua of Abu Hamza, O God, bestow mercy on me. We ask God to show mercy on us and bestow your blessings on me when they put me on the ground, washing my body, and when my dear ones and relatives turn me over to different sides. We ask Allah the Exalted to bestow His mercy and blessings on us when our body is being washed after death. At that moment, we are involuntarily in the hands of those who perform ghusl. This will happen to each and every one of us. None of us will escape that moment. It will happen to all of us, and therefore you should think about it. And show kindness to me when my people carry my corpse into the grave. They carry us, hold us on their shoulders, and take us to our eternal home. And be generous towards me when I am alone in my grave, entering upon you. They will bury us in a grave. This is a reminder. So, we should not ignore these moments, and they should always be in front of our eyes. This is one of the reasons why we are advised to visit graveyards and the dead.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some people do not like it when they are reminded of death. They should not dislike it because this is a cure and medicine. It is a cure for our selfishness, our ignorance, and our lust. We read in another part of the holy dua of Abu Hamza, O God, bestow your mercy on me when I have no answer to give, when I cannot find my tongue to give you answers, and when my mind makes a mistake when you ask me a question. When we are short of answers before divine questions, we should know that divine questions are not like the ones that are asked in this world. In this world, we can maneuver the other side by using his own folly, ignorance, and emotions, but there, everything is clear to the being who questions us. Therefore, we should think about that moment.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.